I listen to music, Chad.
I thought you were just listening to, like, highlights whenever you have your headphones in.
Nah, I used to watch highlights in the background.
Right.
I have Spotify. Look, I have Discover Weekly as much as anybody.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about sports. 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chad Matlin, an editor at 538. With me in the studio, Mets hat backwards.
It's that kind of day, Chad.
Neil Payne.
Is it really?
Writer at 538.
It is that kind of day, Kate.
It's a backwards hat.
And your hat's really backwards?
Yeah, why not? I've got the headset on. I think I look like a...
That's a good look.
So you're broing it out. You're just broing
it's a
it
bro
out.
Out.
If there's any adjective I'd use to describe Neil Payne, it's yeah. Bro.
Bro.
That other voice you hear all the way across the country in Oregon, Kate Fagan. Hello, Kate.
Hi, Chad.
I really hope that some enterprising Hot Takedown listener fan will start mapping your travels on show days, because I feel like it would be a great like data visualization of where in the world.
And next week I'll be in Los Angeles.
Ooh. Are you coming back to the East Coast in between?
Yes.
Oh, God.
Yes.
Kate. Man. Yeah.
And I was going to say, this might be
crazy.
Like one of those data science things where you actually predict where Kate will be next based on on your movements so far.
Did you guys see on Twitter, somebody said we had the best podcast start theme music in podcasting history?
Wow.
Whoa.
Were you guys on that tweet?
I don't know if I was, but I think it's irrefutable now that someone's pointed it out.
We should maybe hot take down that. Do we have analytics behind it?
That is a hot take. It's a hot take we endorse.
Is Mystery Mansion theme the best of all time?
I'm sure Mystery Mansion is listening right now and would not argue with
it's
that.
Compelling. All right, let's get on with the show. On today's show, the Western Conference Finals are here, and some bro on the internet named Neil Payne says it's the strongest conference finals matchup in decades. We'll break down the series, the Thunder's victory in the first game, and whether the Warriors are really on the ropes as numerous ESPN headlines have suggested today. Rasheed Wallace may also make an appearance at the end of that segment.
Metaphorically.
Ooh. Yeah. He's actually with Kate in Oregon right now. And then female athletes get concussions too. Who knew? With all the attention paid to concussions in the NFL, it's easy to overlook that women and girls are suffering head trauma on the field as well. Christy Ashwanden, one of 538's science writers, will join us to discuss what research suggests may be different about the way that women suffer concussions, and perhaps some research that suggests that they're more susceptible to getting concussions on the field. And then finally, a sumo would be something different, like Sumerian culture kind of thing. A sumo matchup.
This sumo data almost goes far back to the Sumerians.
Finally, a sumo matchup centuries, not millennia, in the making. Is Hakuho, the white pang, the dominant force in sumo over the past decade, better than any sumo wrestler who has ever lived? 538's Benjamin Morris has analyzed hundreds of years of sumo stats and has an answer for us. And then Kate will bring a significant digit wrapped in a bow with one of those glittery gift tags on top. Kate, do you want to spoil what the sig dig is, or you want to keep the suspense going?
No, I want people to last all the way to the end of the show, because you know once they hear the sig dig, they know they won't be able to be topped.
Right. Excellent point. All right. Stay tuned for sig dig. All right. Let's get to the NBA. I think probably the native sport of Hot Takedown. Seems like that's where our hot takedowns and our own hot takes are strongest.
Our Venn diagrams intersect at the NBA.
I will be surprised if the Oklahoma City Thunder win a single game of this
season. Stop, Skip.
I gave them on Friday. I'm going to give them one game because inevitably Steph and Clay will have one of those nights, one of those cold nights. I'm sorry. The Golden State Warriors are too deep. They're too versatile. They do too many things. And finally, Steph Curry is just too great for the Oklahoma City Thunder.
Do you guys also, when you hear Skip's voice now, like remix it in your own head?
You hear the
yeah, it sounds like that to me now.
That I hear sort of the track skipping as he speaks. That's what happens.
So that was Skip Bayless saying why he'd be surprised if Thunder won any games, and then saying the Thunder would win one game, sort of having it both ways. And then,
another way good for the Thunder.
Right. And then, sure enough, last night, Monday night, the Thunder won a game. Steph and Clay weren't even that cold, despite what Skip forecast would happen. Instead, Kevin Durant was going 10 for 30 from the field, yet the Thunder came from behind and won 108 to 102. So I guess what I'm interested in is whether there is a shred of truth in what Skip Bayless was saying, which is that, you know, the Thunder were going to sneak a game in this series regardless at some point. We just happen to see that happen. Or alternatively, do the Thunder now have the edge in this series the way that I feel like a lot of things I've read today, just based off this one win on the road at a place that Golden State doesn't lose very often, suggested that they do?
Yeah, I mean, you have to think that if they were going to have this kind of sneak in a victory at some point in the series, if that was the way that a game would be won for OKC, it would probably come in Oklahoma City, right? Like the fact that it happened in Golden State and in game one of the series suggests that maybe the Thunder are more of a force to be reckoned with than Skip gave them credit for.
And even like watching the game last night, and I know the statistics show that Golden State, although it looked like they were taking really ill-advised shots, especially like at the end of the third and into the fourth quarter, it wasn't like their quality of shots, at least according statistically, were like horribly bad. I mean, certainly there was like the Klay Thompson three kind of like deep in the right corner with like a few minutes left where you're like, whew. And they see, but like Golden State has been doing that kind of stuff all year long. But the thing that stood out to me more than anything was how Oklahoma City was like switching so well. And it was almost like there were occasional times when their switches would cost them because somebody wouldn't recognize it soon enough and Steph would have an open look. But for the most part, it really was kind of shocking to me, you know, having watched them all year long, but certainly having seen Golden State more often, how you could actually see how their plan of switching everything would force Golden State into at least a level of difficulty shooting that could force them to take and miss more threes than we're used to them seeing.
Right, and to your point about the quality of shots, I looked at all the games that the Warriors played this year, and we can kind of, using the SportView tracking data from all those fancy cameras, we can quantify the quality of every shot that a player takes based on where it was taken from and, you know, how close the defender was. This was in the 48th percentile of all of their games, so it was actually pretty close to the median, pretty close to their normal game in terms of shot quality. It was in the 16th percentile of all of their shot making games in terms of, you know, what their field goal percentage was after adjusting for the difficulty of the shots that they took. So they were taking pretty normal shots by their standards. They just weren't making them at their usual rate. And to be fair, that stat, that shot making stat from game to game or from season to season, that's a super noisy stat, which suggests that a lot of it is luck or, you know, kind of the cold hand just kind of hits you at a certain moment. And that's a little of what Skip was saying, that they had a bad shooting night. You know, Steph and Clay definitely were less efficient, far less efficient than they were during the regular season. But at the same time, Oklahoma City's defense during the regular season was the number one defense in all of basketball at suppressing shot making by opposing teams. So in that sense, maybe some of that you could expect to persist, even if it is kind of a noisy metric from game to game.
So that's what I'm trying to figure out. And Neil, do you have those numbers on the Thunder by any chance?
Or shot making?
Yeah, but I'm just curious because what we've talked before about those overlapping distribution of outcomes basically, mm-hmm. for different teams and whether or not the tails overlap. We've talked before about, you know, if there's a big favorite, where will the back tail, the tail of them performing really poorly, mm-hmm. overlap with
like
the,
with UConn
the front
women's
tail.
Basketball,
exactly. And so will that if the Warriors have a really bad night and Thunder have a really good night, then that's the only moment where the Thunder can win? Or are there more? Is there more overlap?
To be honest, their overall shooting effective field goal percentage in the entire game was in the 49th percentile of all of their games this year, which is normal for them. And it was kind of the inverse of how Golden State shot the ball, where Golden State had a really bad game by shot quality, shot making, even though the quality was fine. In this case, Oklahoma City shot below their usual sort of adjusted for quality shooting. They just got a ton of better shots. And I think that also speaks to something that I wrote about earlier this week about the quality of the Thunder bigs, that they were able to get shots as a team that were better shots than they usually are able to get against a Golden State defense that really is no slouch when it comes to, defending even against, efficient types of shots.
And it also looked like, watching Golden State, and this is something that I was trying to keep an eye out for, and it's probably impossible to put a number to, but down the stretch of the game, it felt like they had people taking shots that were not necessarily the right shot at the right time. It was like Harrison Barnes was shooting some shots where you're like, and there were multiple possessions where at certain points it didn't go through Curry at all, and Draymond Green was off. And so even though like Golden State shot selection wise seemed like you said was at like what 49th percentile for the season, it almost felt a little bit like watching them anyway that being without Steph for certain chunks of this postseason, having to kind of rearrange how they play and who takes what shot when, and then having Steph back now, even though when he first came back it seemed like it was seamless and he had what 17 points in an overtime like we talked about last week, there could still be hiccups once you get everybody back together after sort of the initial, all right, adrenaline rush of like, we're going to work through this and Steph is back and we got all our crew back. Well, then there can be times where the rhythm of all of that is still a little bit off. And it felt like that watching Golden State in the fourth quarter.
Oh, yeah, you nailed it, Kate. This was actually their second worst shot quality fourth quarter of any game that they played all season long. Which sort of speaks to that just shot selection issue that they had. And, credit goes also to the Thunder for kind of, I know that Golden State sort of thrives on shots that other teams would perhaps, be considered bad shots for them. But I think even within that, there's something to be said for the defense that they played against Golden State down the stretch.
So I guess what I'm still struggling to understand from what you guys are saying then is whether or not this was indicative of the series. I mean, it seems like it's going to be a tight series regardless, but was it indicative that maybe the Thunder do have an edge in the series? Or is it that the Warriors got unlucky in the moment that they regressed to the mean, their own mean, that it's going to be that they'll have the 6-point lead at the end of the game instead?
Wasn't it always the case that it's kind of, somewhere in between where it's like a little column A, a little column B?
Damn it, Neil. I want answers.
Yeah, and I would expect now to some degree that Golden State would rise, have that shooting percentage rise, especially the shot selection in the fourth quarter. It would be hard to believe that you would then see another fourth quarter where Curry didn't make it clear that he exert himself more and take more shots. But Neil said, it's not like Oklahoma City was even firing on all cylinders either. So, I mean, as Neil said, it's kind of like I expect a little bit more from Golden State shot selection in the fourth and a little more Curry. But then, I mean, if Durant even goes like 3-for-7 during that stretch, he was 0-for-7, then you kind of got a bunch of close ball games in a row.
Yeah. Just because of that one win, the Thunder are now forecasted by 538 to be the victor of the conference finals and also have the greatest chance of winning the title just because of this one win on the road against the Warriors. That's how much a road win can mean.
Yeah, I think totally. I mean, also the fact is that, the Warriors they're actually lower now than they were going into the finals a year ago by ELO. And the Thunder have kind of gone on this meteoric rise, beating San Antonio certainly does wonders for one's power rating. And so I think that's a combination of what you said. It's like they're close enough, evenly enough matched, even though we think of the Warriors as being this, juggernaut that can't be stopped. And they did sweep the season series against the Thunder, but you know, they're close enough at this point, and in concert with the fact that if the game, if the series goes seven, the Thunder will have more games at home. Even if it goes six, that you know, it's enough to tilt things slightly in their favor.
All right, I want to talk about one more bit of NBA news. It is not the Eastern Conference Finals, which I'm sure we will talk about next week.
It's after the 2005 Eastern Conference Finals, maybe.
Let's. Where to begin with Rasheed Wallace and his hypothesis that ball don't lie? Let's listen to him explicate his worldview about the ball not lying.
Start doing bad habits on the floor.
Dragic misses the technical. And a technical foul on Rasheed Wallace. He's gone. Ball don't lie. That's what he always yells. Now, I don't know why he received a second technical for that.
Wallace gets the foul. You could have given it to Wallace or Kidd on the reach. And free throws now for Austin Rivers. To get between your ears.
Oh, my God.
So for those not familiar, Rasheed Wallace believed that when an inaccurate foul was called,
i.e. every foul that was ever called against Rasheed Wallace.
But it seemed like in some of those that he wasn't the one shooting the free throws, that it was a full team effort,
right?
Or it was any foul against the team, that if it was an inaccurate call, that the ball would not go in the ensuing free throw, because it was it wouldn't lie. It would. The ball was telling the truth about whether the foul was accurate.
The
or
ball
not.
Knew that it had no business going right to the basket.
So, the Wall Street Journal has done really just Yaman's work here and done an analysis.
Yao Ming's work.
Yeah, has done an analysis of two seasons of bad referee calls. Calls that the NBA admits are bad through this program.
Right, they have these reports or whatever after every game.
Just of the last 2 minutes of the game. So it took two seasons worth of calls that the NBA acknowledges were bad, and found that there have been 177 free throws in two seasons that were the direct results of 92 incorrect calls in the final minutes of close games. All right, Kate and Neil, do you think the ball lies?
I don't even want to know the answer to this because I love the existing mythology, which has existed on every court I've ever played on, where when somebody misses a free throw after a bad call, everybody kind of looks at each other in the other team and is like, yep, karma, baby. So I don't even want to know that sort of like cosmic karmic belief is complete BS. So are you going to tell me it's BS, Chad?
I'm just going to tell you to mute your line if you want to stay totally ignorant.
I love it. I don't want to believe something else.
All right. I'm gonna say the answer. Neil, unless you want to tell me that secretly you believe the ball don't lie this entire time.
No, my hypothesis going in was that it was going to be the same between bad calls and good calls. Sorry, Kate.
Well, I didn't believe it would be different because I've shot free throws numerous times after a bad call, and don't think I didn't want those points just as badly as when it was
a
good call.
Sure. So it cuts both ways.
The finding. Yeah. Quote, there was virtually no difference in the NBA players' free throw percentage after poor officiating. The players in the sample who benefited from lousy whistles were expected to make 79.1% of the ensuing free throws. They made 78.5%.
So that's slightly less. I mean, I know it's not probably statistically significant, but maybe that
karma,
0.6 of a percentage point.
Karma can't do much, but
karma.
Every now and then it just whispers on the rim.
Right, that's like one extra missed free throw every, I don't know, couple months or something.
All right, let's leave it there. Let's leave Rasheed there. Let's not bother his legacy any more than we already done. Rasheed, we love you. We wanted to believe. Kate still believes, but you know the numbers just didn't hold up.
I muted the line, so I'm fine.
Well, Rasheed, appear on the show as a rebuttal, and we'll make some free throws. We'll have some fouls called, and we'll take some shots.
All right, let's move on. And before we keep going with the show, a word from our sponsor this week. Have you ever been frustrated trying to buy tickets online? Most sites make it complicated and then try to sneak in huge fees at checkout. That's why you need to try SeatGeek. They made it easier than ever to buy and sell sports and concert tickets. SeatGeek pulls all the tickets available on other sites into one place. It's an aggregator, you know. It scans the web. It's got the best tickets on the web, so you save time and never miss a deal. You can even set alerts for upcoming games and SeatGeek will let you know if ticket prices fall. Even better, every ticket on SeatGeek has a deal score based on its value, so you can immediately find underpriced seats. And before you buy, you can use SeatGeek's detailed maps to see the view from your seat. Best of all, SeatGeek is always honest and upfront about the price. Unlike StubHub, SeatGeek shows you the full ticket price from start to finish and never surprises you with huge fees at checkout. Importantly, you get free money. Listeners of Hot Takedown get a $20 rebate off their first SeatGeek purchase. Here's how to do it. Download the free SeatGeek app. Number one, go to the settings tab. Number two, click add a promo code. Number three, here's the important part. Number four, enter the promo code TAKEDOWN, as in Hot Takedown. From there, SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. Again, to do all that, download the free SeatGeek app and enter promo code TAKEDOWN today. All right, now on to concussions and whether or not they affect men and boys differently than they affect women and girls. A lot of the conversation around concussions is around how it affects male athletes, whether it be football players or soccer players or whatnot. We've seen recently a movement in women's sports towards athletes saying they're going to donate their brains after they die to see whether or not the effect of concussions, let's say, suffered in soccer are affecting them the way that they concussions have affected men. Christy Ashwanden, one of 538 science writers, has written a column about this for 538. Christy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I believe it is your Hot Takedown debut. Congratulations. Very excited.
Great to be here, yeah.
So, Christy, you write a sports science column for 538 called Strength in Numbers. And this week's column, you looked at the scientific research around how concussions affect the genders differently. What did you find?
Yeah, it was really interesting. It turns out that when women are playing the same sports as men, so same equipment, same fields, etc., in sports like soccer, basketball, things like this, they have about 1.5 times the rate of concussions as boys and men do. And so it's kind of interesting. I was surprised by this, and I think a lot of people are.
And did the scientists offer any reasons of why that multiplier would have been there?
Yeah, I mean, now the search is on for reasons. You know, this gender difference is pretty well established at this point. Last week on Friday, there was just a congressional hearing about this, actually, not about gender specifically, but about concussions in youth sports. And there was some testimony there. And in fact, one of the congresspeople asked, you know, do we need more data on this gender difference? And the answer was no. Like, it is pretty well established now. It's been replicated that there is this gender difference that girls and women tend to get more concussions for the same amount of playing time as boys and men in sports. And the reasons aren't clear. There are some hypotheses that have been put up, but none of them are really confirmed yet.
And we're talking about, which are the sports that are most predominant in kind of on both sides of the sample for boys and girls?
Right. Well, so obviously women and girls don't play football for the most part. Mm-hmm. But in basketball and soccer, those are sports. Lacrosse is another one that have higher rates of concussions. And one thing that was really interesting to me is, so when we think of soccer concussions, we think of, you know, heading the ball. But it turns out that a lot of these concussions are actually player-to-player interactions. So it's not just, you know, there have been things proposed like, well, we need to teach better technique for heading the ball and things like that. But it turns out that a lot of these concussions really happen with player-player interactions. So it's, you know, knocking your head against another player or maybe falling down, hitting your head on the ground, you know, as a result of an interaction. So it's not just a matter of, you know, hitting the ball with your head.
Christy, I know that you said that the search is on for the why, but when you dug into this data, I guess, was there any dissection of perhaps some of the differences in numbers being just a more readily accessible population in women that are willing to admit that they're hurt? You know, because it's like, I'm doing this book now on like mental health issues, and some of the spike in numbers is just young people being more willing to say that they have anxiety or depression. And was there any indication within the data that within women's sports and female athletes, they're more willing to say like, I don't feel right.
Right. That's a really good question. And that is a theory that's been thrown up that, like, well, it's just, you know, men and boys tend to have more of a culture of, like, tough guy, you know, everything's cool, I'm fine, I'm all right. But when they actually looked, so one of the researchers that I interviewed for the story runs a specialty concussion clinic in Canada. And she actually looked at people who had come into her clinic. And it turned out that it wasn't just that the women that were coming in and the girls that were coming in were, like, expressing more symptoms and saying that they were unwell, but the objective symptoms were also greater. And so it may still be true that, you know, on the initial sign of concussion, that girls are more likely and women are more likely to say something and to say, well, wait a minute, you know, maybe I did hit my head and I should take a little time out here than boys and men. Although I get the sense that that culture is changing a little bit. But so that's a really great theory. It's one that really isn't proven at this point. And in fact, we seem to have some evidence to the contrary at this point.
And Christy, are there physiological differences that maybe are the cause of this? I think you mentioned something about maybe the neck strength being different in boys and girls or in men and women, and as a result, maybe I think, as you put it, the brain was sloshing around differently in this skull.
Right. So what's happening when you have a concussion is you're having this motion in your head. Yeah, so basically, it's sort of like, you know, imagine that you're body is stopping very suddenly and your brain is kind of sloshing around in your skull, and it's accelerating. So if your body stops, the brain is still accelerating inside it. It's almost like if you had a pickup truck or something and you hit the brakes, like the object in the back of the truck is still going to slide around. So that's what's happening, and that's why helmets and things like that are never going to be completely effective in preventing concussions or addressing concussions, because you're really talking about movement inside the skull. But one idea that's been thrown up is that perhaps girls have, you know, that their necks are not as strong, and so they may be not as good at sort of bracing themselves when they get hit. So they may be having and experiencing more motion in their heads when they're hit, and so they may just be getting yanked around more. But again, I think this is really a hypothesis. It's not something that, from what I can tell, has been actually tested. It's not something that has data. So again, it's kind of like, well, girls and women are weaker, so maybe this is the thing. And I'm not saying it's not true, but I think that it's something that we don't have strong evidence for. What we do have more evidence for, though, is there are hormonal differences. So estrogen and progesterone both are known to have effects in the brain. And so it may be something going on there. And this is something, there's a little bit of evidence. There's one study that I found out of University of Rochester, I believe, where they had actually found that depending on where a woman was in her menstrual cycle, the outcomes of the concussion seemed to be different. So that at certain times of the month, getting a concussion was maybe worse than at others. Now, this is small studies. You know, I don't think that we have definitive proof here, but it's kind of stuff that's saying, yeah, there may be something going on with hormones.
What's really scary is that, you know, when we think about concussions, I think a lot of people think about the NFL and just football in general. And football kind of bills itself as this, you know, high speed, high contact sport, in which, you know, at the very least, you could say people kind of know, especially at the pro level, what they're kind of getting into. But this sort of suggests that even sports that are sort of billed as less high contact or even non-contact run the risk, a very sizable risk of, you know, head injuries within. And I think that's a little surprising to a lot of people.
Absolutely. And this goes back to this idea that it's, you know, it's not necessarily the direct contact with the head and the ball that are causing these concussions, that it can be these other interactions. And so I think that a lot of this is just a growing awareness of the problem. And so there are things that were happening before that people just weren't paying attention to. And once you start it, it's this thing that we see over again and again, you know, when you're looking at data, that, you know, once you have this change where people are starting to actually pay attention to data or to collect data that wasn't collected before, all of a sudden, you know, you see things that you weren't aware of because you weren't paying attention before.
And do we have any in examples of this point of brains of former female athletes who have died, who have donated, or who may have thought to have the same types of symptoms of CTE, who then after death we have actually diagnosed CTE in a former female athlete's brain? Or are we not even to that point yet?
That's a great question, Kate. And the answer is we're not to that point yet, but we did just have, sadly, tragically, China professional wrestler died recently, and her brain was donated to look at CTE. Now, this just happened a few weeks ago, so I don't think that we have any answers yet. I don't know where the research is add on that yet. And I'm not aware of, you know, whether she was having symptoms that could have been indicative of this or not. But that's a good question. And that's why it's really interesting and sort of exciting that some of these women soccer players now have pledged to donate their brains when they die, which I hope will be a long time from now. Yeah, so it will be a while before we have answers on this. But no, as of yet, we don't have any really good data on this.
All right, listeners, you can check out Chrissy's work on concussions and how they may affect the genders differently at 538.com. The headline is Women Get Sports Concussions at Higher Rates Than Men. Chrissy, thanks for coming on Hot Takedown.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, now on to sumo wrestling. Kate couldn't be here. She'll be back later in the show. Instead, we have Benjamin Morris, one of 538 sports writers, with us. Hello, Ben.
Hey.
So, Ben, you wrote a piece for the site last week called The Sumo Matchup, Centuries in the Making. It compares Hakuho, who is a sumo wrestler, who is the best currently fighting, and to historical greats, essentially. So let's talk about Hakuho first, and then we'll go back in time. What can you tell us about Hakuho?
He's a Mongolian wrestler. He's 31. In the last 10 years, he's won 36 sumo tournaments. There are six of those per year, so it's about the same as winning 24 majors in a sport that has four majors, like golf or tennis. He has the highest winning percentage of any wrestler in the modern era. And right now, actually, he's in the middle of a tournament where he's started out 10-0. He's won his last 24 matches, which is not even his longest win streak. He seems to do that sort of thing fairly often. And he's been on top of the sport for a long time now.
And so one of the ways that he won earlier this year was with a move called a Hanka, I believe it's pronounced, in which when an oncoming opponent came at him, he sort of stepped to the side. First he thrust his hand out in front of him and then stepped to the side, and the opponent basically ran out of the ring. And where I think I would watch that as a non-sumo devotee and think, oh, that was pretty savvy, sort of to dodge out of the way of an oncoming advance. The sumo community found that almost like a breach of protocol. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a completely uncommon thing. It happens in sumo, but it was extremely strange to happen between two Yokozuna. The opponent he was facing, Harama Fuji, is also a Yokozuna from Mongolia, and it was in the final match of the tournament that would actually determine, well, if Hakuho won, he would win the title immediately. And if he lost, he would be forced into a playoff with another wrestler. So it was a very consequential match as well. And it's really unheard of to see that move used in such an important match by such prominent wrestlers. But, I mean, yeah, it's one of the really interesting things for me to try and understand about sumo is how you have this thing that seems not only like some incidental rule that can be exploited, but it seems like so essential almost to the sport that to effective strategy would be, you know, using someone else's momentum to your advantage and jumping out of the way sometimes in order to get them not to charge at you like a missile would also happen to be something that is really deeply frowned upon. It's one of the things that really blows my mind about the sport.
So did Hakuho kind of figure out like a almost like unlock the secret of modern sumo, or is this something that, you know, as part of, you know, his comparisons to the past, you said that other champions don't do this particular move. Has that been one of the keys to his record so far, or, you know, is this something that he just started doing?
He's actually not known for using Hanka very often. I wouldn't say that other champions don't use them. In fact, someone posted in the comments that Harama Fuji, his opponent in this match, used one against Hakuho in 2012 in a match that actually looked very similar, where Hakuho charged right out of the ring. So there's speculation that it could have been revenge or something like that. but it's very rare between Yokozuna like that. And then it's also rare in important matches where it's considered you're really supposed to bring your best sumo, sort of. So you normally see it like earlier in a tournament. Younger wrestlers will try to use it to beat older wrestlers or more experienced wrestlers if they don't think they have a very good shot otherwise. Or occasionally it's used by wrestlers who are injured. It gets you a very like quick match without having to hit another person at high speed who is very powerful. And then some wrestlers have reputations for using them more often than others. So it's something that's been around all the time. People have always kind of complained about it, but it's never been like a central part of like someone's main strategy to the sport.
So Ben, the thrust of your article is to compare Hakuho to the historical greats, the way that we have sort of barroom arguments all the time, especially on Hot Takedown, about who the greatest of all time is. In this instance, though, like all time is centuries and centuries of data, and all that data, of wrestlers, and all of those wrestlers' data actually exists on a site called Sumo Reference. So when you did the analysis, what did you find about how the sport had changed, and who does Hakuho measure up to?
Well, I mean, the main name that it's fun to compare Hakuho is Raiden, who, I mean, I just love that name, shows up in video games all the time. But, I mean, he was an amazing sumo wrestler who started in the 1790s. And, you know, he won 96% of his matches. Raiden was really stands alone in historical sumo wrestling legends. So it was extremely fun to try and compare him to Hakuho. And it's hard to get an angle on that because the sport has not stayed exactly the same for 250 years. And it's one of the things I tried to do in the story was try and figure out, like, how unusual was Raiden for his time relative to how unusual is Hakuho in the present. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I think Hakuho is probably more of an insane outlier than Raiden was.
And why is that?
I mean, it's just really hard to win 85% of your matches as an Ozeki. Actually, he's won a higher percentage of his matches as a champion than he did before he was a champion, which is difficult in sumo because when you are a champ, you get the toughest schedule in every tournament, essentially. He's won an extremely high percentage of his matches, which has been really rare in the last 50 years or so. Even the really great wrestlers, that great sumo wrestlers we've seen, have not won as often as that. Whereas back in Raiden, the champions of the sport regularly won 90% of their matches. So I came up with Waro's wins above replacement Ozeki, as a rough way of trying to set a baseline for just how much more than what is to be expected of a sumo champion did they do, and Hakuho came out well ahead of Raiden on that metric.
And Ben, one of the interesting things, or one of the most interesting things that I thought was in your story was about the rise of the Mongolians, basically. The fact that they really didn't participate that much in sumo until very recently, especially by the standards of such an old sport. And yet they seem to have very quickly started to win a lot. And does that speak to almost like the talent pool that Hakuho is facing now is much deeper than that which, you know, somebody like Raiden would have faced in the past, just because of, you know, there are more people and a larger pool of competitors to kind of go up against?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's a tough sport to crack into if you're not Japanese, because they actually limit the number of wrestlers that are allowed to be in the sport who aren't Japanese. Yet we've seen in the last decade, the Mongolians have won 57 now, Basho. And then someone from Estonia won one, and someone from Bulgaria, I want to say, won one. And before that, actually, you had the Hawaiian wrestlers from the United States winning a bunch of Basho as well. So the Japanese haven't even dominated the sport at any point since, like, the 80s, which I think does speak to it's been kind of spreading slowly into other places. It's really remarkable, though, that the Mongolians can have 5% of the wrestlers and win nearly 100% of the tournament.
Ben, one last question for you. Has that prompted like a response from within Japan about trying to train their wrestlers better to be able to compete with the Mongolians, or are the Japanese resigned to having the sport be a more international one?
I mean, the one wrestler per stable being international rule is fairly recent. That was partly a response to the growing internationalization of the sport. Some might say a slightly xenophobic response to it. I think a lot of people in Japan are kind of disappointed that they're not on top of the sport, but they're mostly resigned to it having international competition. I know Katoshi Shogiku, the one who just won for the first time for Japan in a long time, has said in interviews that he just thought Japanese wrestlers needed to want it more or something. To be more fierce competitors.
Hot take. What a hot take.
Yes, I know.
All right, Ben, thanks so much for coming on.
You bet. Anytime.
Listeners, you can read Ben's work at 538.com, along with an interactive history of sumo that goes back more than 250 years from before the founding of America. That's how old. That's how much data is packed into this thing. And now it's time for Significant Digit, when a telling number from the world of sports is dropped on our laps. This week, dropping it is Kate Fagan, who is back from her one-segment hiatus. Kate, what do you have for us?
Guys, this is my maiden voyage as the bringer of the sig dig.
Is that true?
So it is. Wow. It is. So hopefully this isn't too clumsy. I'm going to try my work my way through it. The significant digit I brought us today is 1997, as in the year that the WNBA has announced it's going to go back to and categorize and analyze and provide advanced stats.
Whoa.
For all the WNBA games from 1997 to present day. So that's 20 years worth, where it's going to now have the kind of statistics that the three of us have talked about have been lacking in the WNBA, and that we even had Sue Bird, WNBA player for the Seattle Storm, on to talk about her piece on the dearth of analytics in the WNBA. The WNBA is now going to provide that kind of statistics, which I think opens the door to some more storytelling and more of an ability to incorporate the WNBA in our podcast, as well as for people that want to play fantasy. At least now, all of those numbers are going to be out on the table.
Neil, what are, like, if in this treasure trove, I know you haven't looked into it too deeply yet, but like, what are the WNBA sort of storylines you think you're itching to do, or just like in general should be done around the game?
Well, I don't know. I mean, being able to kind of quantify the best players and the best teams of all time, and kind of anything that you can do to kind of expand the narrative and sort of also expand the context in which you can put current things in, I think is, and I think we've talked about this in the past, Kate, about how it just is about kind of building the lore of a league and giving fans the opportunity to kind of put it in this story and in this narrative sense, and statistics are a great way to do that for the past.
Yeah, and you just have no way now. I mean, it's hard enough to sit around with people and be like, no, Tina Thompson was better. No, she wasn't. You know, Sylvia Fowles is better. I mean, that's hardly ever happening. One, because there's not enough cultural capital there to have that conversation, but also in large part because there was absolutely nothing to argue anything with other than I saw her play once, or I watched that season once. You couldn't be like, but her true field goal percentage, but this, but that.
Well,
I'm not saying that. All,
I'm going to be curious.
All of a sudden, people are going to have those conversations, but at least there's the ability now to have put more numbers to things you might have been thinking.
I mean, I am going to be curious as to what they add, because Basketball Reference does have, you know, sort of the box score suite of stats, you know, like true shooting, and I remember when we had Sue Bird on, I dug into and kind of scraped all that data and used it for my little homebrewed WNBA all-time player ranking. So hopefully this kind
right.
of push to add, you know, the stats and stuff, and you said they were going to go back and sort of break down all the games back to 97 on like a game-by-game level. Hopefully that'll include more than just what you can find right now at Basketball Reference. Like if I want, you know, some kind of game finder tool where I want to be able to figure out, you know, at any given moment, like what was the best, you know, the best performance on offense and defense in a given game, or gosh, if they had play-by-play for all the things, you could, you know, come up with clutch stats. So there's stories that can be told there. You know, it's kind of limitless depending on the data, and I'm hoping that this kind of push is more than just like a PR thing where they're sort of dressing up similar things that you can find at Basketball Reference already, but that it actually is substantive beyond that, and that you can kind of take it to places that you can do in the men's game that I think has enriched our understanding on that side.
Kate, let me ask one more question before we wrap. And it's sort of like, I guess, a statistical ethics question when doing stats for women's sports. And I think there's going to be a temptation to compare the way the women's game works, let's say, WNBA games work, let's say, to NBA games, right? To say, perimeter shooting in the WNBA is more important than in the NBA, or vice versa. And I wonder, since you think about this stuff a lot, whether is there like a right way to go about that, so that you treat the WNBA on its own terms and not only contextualize it relative to the men's game?
Well, I mean, I totally get that. My fear would be that no matter how much the analytics and the numbers actually showed us the different ways in which the game was played and the differences and maybe the things that sometimes women's basketball might do different, because in essence, it is a different game when you take away the slam dunk and like the certain physicality of it. You would hope that it would be a way to quantify the differences that highlight how it's a different game rather than just numbers mm-hmm. that then mm-hmm. can be cherry picked to prove that women are inferior, you know, I mean, which inevitably might happen, but you would hope that people would use it to rather say, well, look how this game is driven. It's driven maybe perhaps on like a higher, you know, assist per basket, or there could be certain statistics where you're like, yeah, these are the differences in the game.
All right,
not
let's
necessarily
leave it there for now. Now that we have these stats, I have a feeling we'll be talking about WNBA even more than we already do. And that'll do it for this week's show, I think. Kate Fagan, thanks for calling in from Oregon.
All the way from Oregon. Thanks for having me, Chad.
Absolutely. You know, you're always welcome, Kate. In fact, you're welcome every week. That's
every single week on Tuesday yeah. afternoon.
I know. What a treat. Neil Payne, you know, you brought it today, Neil.
Thanks, Chad.
You had good stats.
I feel like you say that every week, but it's always
sometimes
appreciated.
Sometimes I like give you a backhanded compliment. This is a front-handed.
Okay.
Take what you can. our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast juror is Jody Avergan. Jody slacked me during this taping to say he was selected on a jury. So he's very excited.
I bet.
Yeah. We got production assistance from Jonathan Yales today. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. You can find us on your favorite podcasting app. We're also on iTunes. Subscribe at iTunes.com/538. Be sure to review and rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. There are two other shows, What's the Point and 538 Elections. Review those two. Our theme song yep. is by Mystery Mansion. Kate, you're fading out. I feel like that's like, this is the way you're saying by the show. Very slowly, you're breaking up.
I got kicked out of my classroom, and now I'm just in a random hallway. So,
all right. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to both of you and all of our listeners next time.